Having a high contrast with blinding light coming through a south window makes it harder to see the interior of the church than if you modulate the light and put a veil of colored light. It actually relaxes the eye and allows it to see more clearly more of the dark areas, which I think also has a little bit of a spiritual dimension to it, if you think about it.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. For now, we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. I've always loved this verse in 1 Corinthians. I've loved it for the way it illuminates and hands us a big mystery at the same time. So Paul is talking about how truth, how who we are, how what we're meant for, the spectrum of human being in all its fullness, how this is revealed in the light of the face of Christ. But now we see through a glass. I kept thinking of this scripture preparing for my conversation with our guest today, because in our modern world of clear mirrors and transparent windows and electric lights, seeing through glass is not usually done very darkly. But one place Paul's image still comes alive, I think, is in stained glass windows. And that is what we're going to be talking about today. Stained glass can be dark and darkening, as many of you who have stained glass in your churches know. And you will also know that it is bright and illuminating at the same time. And as I learned from our guest, what stained glass doesn't reveal of the outdoors with its unmediated sunlight, it makes up for by illuminating what's indoors. By dimming with color and pattern, stained glass can actually bring the beauty of the church into better focus, both with literal light and through the stories it tells. So where does stained glass come from? And why did it become so important to Christians particularly? What can we read in stained glass? And what do we often miss? And how, if you're a steward of stained glass windows yourself, can you take better care of them? My guest today is Leonie Zilica, the stained glass artist responsible for the conservation of the stained glass windows of Canterbury Cathedral. Leonie joined me to talk about the origins and theology of stained glass, and you will not believe how old the art of stained glass actually is. Seriously, you're guessing in your head right now? No, earlier than that. We talk about the limits and complexities of the art and how these open up creative possibility. We chat about what to pay attention to when taking care of stained glass in your church and mistakes not to make. And I get the scoop on a few inside stories about the stained glass in Canterbury Cathedral. Leonie is director of the Cathedral Studios of Canterbury, which makes, designs, and preserves stained glass for churches all over the world. She is a Freeman of the Worshipful Company of Glaziers and an ICON-accredited conservator restorer. In our bonus segment today, we will tip our tri-cornered hats to the United States' 250th birthday with a brief history tour at an Episcopal church with colonial roots, where George Washington was on the vestry. What kind of vestry person was he? Who would he get in arguments with? Stay tuned for that. Now, I hope you're not afraid of heights, because we're going to scale the scaffolding in Canterbury Cathedral and join Leonie for an up-close look at one of the oldest Christian art forms and what it reveals about church history, human longings, and our life in Christ. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Leonie, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, well, Amber, it's such a delight to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Can I just say, first of all, that what you do is so cool. I see pictures of you guys with microscopes, in hard hats, perched up in scaffolding. You're working in archives. You're working in workshops. They're part of what you do is artistic. Part of it is chemistry, probably alchemy. I don't know. You've just got such a cool thing that you're into. Briefly, can you just tell us first a bit about how you even got into working with stained glass?
I've always been really interested in art and in conservation, because it just breaks my heart when I see works of art decay because of neglect or war or what have you, because all that creativity and love and care that goes into making them is just gone. So conservation of art was actually quite high on my list of things I wanted to do with my life, but I didn't know quite what. I thought wall paintings might be nice, until I talked to a wall paintings conservator who talked me out of it, because you're up on a scaffolding in a coal church. I walked into a museum in my hometown, Frankfurt, in Germany, where they had a medieval stained glass panel displayed in such a manner that you could see both sides of it, the inside and the outside. And they had it lit really cleverly. So you had the view, the light coming through, but you had enough light on both sides to see the complexity. When you see a stained glass window in a church, you think it's basically a sheet of colored glass, flat. It's not. But actually, when you get close to it, you realize this is a very, very complex structure. And as it goes through time, it ages, it corrodes, decays, bulges. And there's so much that intrigued me that I decided, you know, that is beautiful and strange and interesting. And that's what I want to do.
When I have artists on the show or people involved in the arts, one of the challenges, especially with the visual arts, is that we're an audio-only podcast. So one of the challenges is to bring them into the world of the thing that we're talking about. So I wonder if we could spend a little time just attempting to do that. And I'd love to start with the history, a little history of stained glass. Can you tell us where it started and what a few key changes in the art form have been?
Sure, yes. You're right. This is a European art form in the very specific manifestation of colored pieces of glass decorated with dark lines and dark washes and then held together with lead strips. You do get colored glass in the Islamic world as well, but the combination of glass and lead and paint is actually uniquely European, and then was exported all over the world from here. And it probably started in the 5th, 6th century in Italy, basically the late Roman world.
Really?
Yeah, it's much older than most people think. But even things that can be dated to the 10th century or the 9th century are also already fully developed stained glass. You know, this is not a very early, hesitant start to the craft. So essentially, we're starting off in the early Middle Ages, the late Roman period, with windows that are made from colored glass. They're not painted on. They're not pigments. You don't get ground up lapis lazuli to make blue glass. That just doesn't happen. They're not dyes like you would use for textiles. They are actually metals, which are mixed with sand and a few additives that allow the melting temperature of the sand to be reduced. Those components are melted together in a pot, and then a glass blower sticks a pipe in there, gathers up a bit of colored glass, and blows a bubble. And that bubble is then elongated by swinging the pipe, so you end up with a cylinder. And when you then cut off the top and the bottom of the cylinder, you have a hollow pipe of colored glass. Now you can then warm that up again and cut through the length of the cylinder and fold out that pipe of glass into a flat sheet. And that is how you blow flat glass. It has changed in that they make larger bottles now, but essentially it's exactly the same.
That's amazing.
In Europe, there are really only two large producers left that make colored glass in this very traditional method, and they are on the UNESCO list of World Heritage of craft, as a craft. Yeah, I find in many people's minds when it comes to stained glass, this idea that stained glass is inherently a little bit of a rough art, that it's rustic, perhaps, not as refined as something you would find in a manuscript or on a panel. And that is true for some windows, but not true for others. They can be really high quality stained glass, even in the Middle Ages, was as fine as anything you find in manuscripts and panel paintings. And I would love to direct people to Canterbury Cathedral, because we have some of the most elegant, sophisticated and beautiful stained glass by the best painters that the 12th and 13th century could possibly supply and money could buy. The content, I think, was from the start twofold. One is figurative windows, subjects of religious content that tell stories, that present you with images that, you know, inspire devotion, remind you of the lives of saints, etc. Some windows would have just had a geometric pattern, always beautiful, always sophisticated. Some windows would be almost colorless, maybe peppered with a few bits of red and blue glass, because that is more expensive than colorless glass. Other windows would have been very richly colored. Depends also who your client is. For instance, the Cistercians liked very, very simple environments, both architecturally and artistically. So in a Cistercian church, you would expect to find non-representational geometric patterns of very great sophistication, but not something that would distract you from your meditations.
It fascinates me that from the beginning, the medium of colored glass is from the beginning a very sophisticated art form and being used to being used in religious buildings. It's being used in churches. It's being used to depict religious and Christian themes. It's just fascinating to me because I don't know if you've ever thought about this, Leonie, but was there something about the medium that lends itself to the message? What is it about colored glass that seemed to be inspiring even very early Christians to say, oh, this is the medium of God's house, or, you know, this is what we're going to tell the story of the Bible in? Or what do you think about that?
The heavenly Jerusalem is described in the Bible as being made from jewels. And so the closest you can come to making a window out of jewels is to make a window out of colored glass. And of course, don't forget, in the Middle Ages, colored glass was often used instead of jewels in, you know, reliquary shrines and so on. Now, on that subject, why stained glass? There's actually a very interesting passage from Abbot Suger, who was the abbot of Saint-Denis in Paris in the 12th century. And he was accused of loving the shiny things too much. You know, all the pearls and the gold and the silver that he liked to amass in his church. And so people basically accused him of being greedy. And he said, no, you misunderstand why I want these materials in my church. I want these materials because they reflect the light of God best. So it makes sense that, you know, the light that is basically our way of perceiving God directly is reflected of something that is precious. However, he says, the most precious thing I have in the church are the stained glass windows. They don't reflect the light. They actually are penetrated by the light without being harmed. That is an allusion to the Virgin Mary. And he defines three different sorts of light. So he talks about the common garden light that is outside, shines on everybody, that is lux in Latin. And then this light travels through the windows and is enriched with the color and with the stories and with the personages that are depicted in the windows. And it basically is enriched, amped up super light that ends up in the church itself, and that he calls lumen. And lumen then enters through the eyes into the soul of the human being and creates illuminatio. Mm-hmm. So that is, according to Suger, the job of a stained glass window. It is actually there to gather God's light, make it even richer by passage through these themes that are depicted in the windows, and then allow illumination to happen in the human soul.
That is so beautiful. And it connects to some things that I've heard, stained glass windows being used as a metaphor for the incarnation, or being used as a metaphor for the way that you mentioned the Virgin Mary, the way that human beings are illuminated, or the way that creation is illuminated by the Creator, and all of our colors, as it were, are brought out fully in the light of God. That just enriches that even more for me. Is there anything that you know of over time that's been lost in stained glass making?
I sometimes joke that if we were transported 800 years back in time, we'd have a job. So as glass painters, glaziers, we could probably adapt very, very quickly to the techniques and the tools that were used then in the 12th and 13th century, because most of those are still in use now. Essentially, we still do things in the same way. However, there are, of course, modern techniques that allow us to apply colored enamels to the surface of glass. So you can basically start with a colorless sheet of glass and paint all the colors you want on there. You can fuse things together in large kilns to create enormous sheets of glass in many, many different colors and textures. So there are really, really exciting new technologies being developed that some of those, I wonder how long they will last. I mean, I work with windows every day that are 800 plus years old, and they're fine. They're not fine. They're corroded. They have lots of problems. They need conservation, consolidation, restoration, protective glazing to keep them going. But, you know, they've had a pretty good stint so far. I wonder how much of the materials that are being produced today will still be there in 500 years' time. But they're fun. They're exciting, they're glorious, they can be used in churches and in airports alike.
Can I ask about one development particularly that excites you, that you, whether or not it'll last for 500 years, that you just think is particularly cool?
I'm such a Luddite.
Bring it.
I think the modern use of acid on glasses that have many layers is really interesting, because acid, hydrofluoric acid, is now used to remove colored layers from glasses that are made in different layers of colored glass. So you can actually work your way like a cameo through glass surfaces. That is not a brand new technique, but it does offer really interesting possibilities. However, this is my big however as a traditionally trained glass artist, I actually enjoy the restrictions that traditional stained glass brings with it, that there are only certain shapes you can cut out of a piece of glass before it breaks, that there are only certain sizes of panels you can produce before you have to make a division, that they need structural support, and those structural supports have always been an integral part of a stained glass window. And that's, you know, you were mentioning it earlier, how complicated it is to make a huge window out of many thousand different pieces of glass and make sure that it doesn't get blown out by the next storm. So it requires a totally integrated approach from many different sides to make a stained glass window work as part of a building. That is the greatest challenge and the greatest interest, that I'm not working on a standalone piece of art that somebody hangs on a wall and then walks away. I'm actually making a contribution to the building as a whole.
Limits, in many ways, are what make art art. Limits are what make, in many ways, artists artists. You have certain things you work with and other things you don't. There are certain kinds of wind velocities that a certain kind of window can stand up to that another window cannot. You can have certain kinds of colors here and there, you can't here or there. I'm curious whether you have a story on hand that might illustrate for us sometime when you really felt like the limits of the craft, but then those limits opened up a possibility that you didn't necessarily expect.
As a stained glass artist, you are trained to anticipate restrictions and then gear your design from the start to work within those restrictions. most often you've already built that into the final product from the start, as part of either the structural entity or the aesthetic appearance of the window.
And then you're also having to work with requests and demands of your clients. So that's taking the restrictions you already have working with your particular art form, and then having to also work within the restrictions of your relationship with the clients and relationship with people. I am thinking that it is extremely possible for people to think of parallels within the art of ministry. You're in a specific parish, which has its specific gifts and its specific limits. Of course, pastoring is an art form. And then you're also working within relationships. Hopefully your parishioners are not clients. Hopefully you don't treat them like clients and they don't treat you the same. But I think there could be a similar kind of way of thinking about coming with the expectation that these are the limits I'm coming with. Beauty is going to emerge within these limits. But then within the relationship, you've got to negotiate these additional limits. Does that tend to be more a place of frustration for you? Or does that tend to be a place of creative excitement where you come to a client and you think, okay, what is this relationship going to ask of us? And what is that going to create? Do you see what I mean? Is it more like a, oh gosh, what are we going to have to work with? A scarcity mentality? Or do you tend to have more a kind of like, I wonder what new opportunity might emerge from this relationship?
It's so enriching to have to work within structural and building constraints and then get from your clients inspiration. Even if it comes with unrealistic ideas at first, you always find a way of working with that and coming up with a wholly new concept that, you know, surprises them and hopefully surprises yourself as well. I feel incredibly lucky and privileged to be part of moments that are incredibly meaningful for people, because many of our clients give windows in memory of somebody. And so I very often find myself sitting opposite somebody who is recently bereaved and is working through that. And to be able to help by making something beautiful and lasting is wonderful and very healing. It's a huge responsibility, of course, but it's a privilege.
Isolation, disconnection from peers, burnout. Many Christian leaders know how this feels. At The Living Church, we realized a long time ago that we weren't just here to be a magazine or a podcast, but a catalyst for connection. Through digital and in-person opportunities, we love creating a sanctuary for the shepherds, cultivating fellowship, continuity, and stability so that leaders can thrive and local churches can too. So how do we do this? Through lots of pastoral emails and phone calls, actually, with friends and subscribers like you, but also in public ways, webinars, conferences, our online covenant journal, teaching and preaching resources, and the Living Church podcast. We're called to encourage those on the front lines of parish ministry. So when you donate to The Living Church, you are funding this lifeline for connection and renewal. Whether it's $5, $50, or $5,000, your gift will not only continue the products and programs that you're enjoying right now, it will encourage and equip another leader like you. Donate to The Living Church today. You can go to livingchurch.org and click donate, or check out the link that's always in the show notes. When I was at, I'm having brain fog and can't remember the name of the cathedral, but it's where Jane Austen is buried. Winchester?
Winchester. Right.
Yeah, Winchester Cathedral. And I was so deeply moved by the memorial window that I think her nephew had commissioned for her. I found it deeply moving and touching because you have that glass panel in the window. And then you look down and there's her tombstone, which also, you know, is a memorial. Yeah, I think that's the difference that I was trying to identify between looking at the tombstone and looking at the memorial stained glass window is one, you're looking down and you're remembering their death, and you're looking up at the window and you're remembering, I think you're remembering their life. It makes it a little easier to remember their life.
And also interesting, you just said you're looking up. My sister's a physiotherapist, and she thinks that the act of looking up actually opens up channels in your body that allow things to come in.
That is really remarkable. Leonie, are there some secrets of the trade that you could share with us? We promise we won't tell. We won't tell anyone. Is there anything you could share with us that might surprise us, for example, about the crafting or the installation of stained glass?
You did actually send me this question beforehand. So I asked our foreman whether he had any secrets of the trade that he thought I should share. And he said, well, they are secrets, so no. He's old school.
Wow.
No, of course. There are lots of interesting things that people find surprising. For instance, we are often asked when people commission a window that please don't make the church too dark. We don't want a dark window. Keep as much light as possible to come through the window. And it's very difficult to explain to them that actually having a high contrast with blinding light coming through a south window makes it harder to see the interior of the church than if you modulate the light and put a veil of colored light. It actually relaxes the eye and allows it to see more clearly, more of the dark areas, which I think also has a little bit of a spiritual dimension to it, if you think about it. So it's not necessarily the best option to have a very, very bright window if you want to be able to see the interior of a building better. And then, of course, the structural considerations are such a big part of windows. And if you get it wrong, it can be really disappointing to the building, to the people who have to look after. So it's a big responsibility to get that right. And when you come to a stained glass window, they are very, very complicated constructs that include structural elements like bars and ferramenta and paraphernalia that make a rigid wall, but a transparent one. So it's quite interesting to just ignore the beauty of it and look at the structure. I think that's a surprise to many people. And it's also surprising how clever our brains are in negating all that structure in the window and just looking at the imagery. Most people are very surprised when I tell them there are lots of horizontal bars in stained glass windows. Oh, no, they're not. Look again.
It's interesting you say that, because the Living Church logo is the image of the Lamb from the Book of Revelation on this, and the seven seals on the scroll. And it was modeled originally to look like stained glass. And so it took us years to realize that whoever had designed our logo had included those horizontal bars in the logo. And someone wrote to me and said, what are these horizontal bars in our logo? Give me a plain logo. And I said, well, I don't know. I've never noticed them before. And then we realized that's because they were modeling it after actual stained glass. And eventually we did take the horizontal bars out of our logo because it didn't make sense in a logo. And it stood out, as opposed to the stained glass. But even in a logo, we stopped seeing the horizontal bars because our eyes were just focusing on the design that we wanted to see and the message and the story that design was telling. Could you give us any other tips, Leonie, for how to read or look at stained glass? I mean, it's architecture, it's art, it's history, it's chemistry. It also seems to me to be a kind of language. I was at King's College, Cambridge. I was there for Evensong a couple of years ago. And I regretted that I did not have binoculars with me, because I would have loved to have spent hours there with a pair of binoculars looking at the intricacies of all the designs. But even as I was just, looking up, clearing out my karma or whatever I was doing by looking up, I still was feeling overwhelmed, like I was hearing beautiful music but didn't quite understand the music. Do you know what I mean? And there were different stories and pieces that I could pick out. But do you have any tips for someone who's not used to reading stained glass, so to speak, for how to notice and appreciate more what we're looking at when we look at it?
Oh, first of all, don't go on a sunny day. Go on a nicely overcast, foggy day, because then you get a soft light that doesn't punch through the windows and make, I mean, you know, it's beautiful when the sun shines through the stained glass window, it all sparkles and what have you, but it literally overwhelms the detail. So if you want to actually appreciate the precise detail in windows, then a foggy day is the perfect day for it. Bring binoculars, because of course the glass painters did their very best for God, not for you down on the floor. I mean, it's nice if you get to see it as well, and they were striving for that. But the lengths they went to make their work perfect is clearly directed to something else. We do have that incredible privilege of getting these wonderful windows on the bench, not from King's College Chapel, but from other places in Canterbury Cathedral, of course. We have them on the bench. We can have microscopes on them. And the perfection and detail and joy in the detail that we find is just overwhelming. And you would never, ever be able, even when they were brand new, you would not have been able to see that 20 meters below. So that's quite fun. Yeah, bring binoculars. But also, I think appreciate the windows as transformers of the space inside the building. So they are, of course, works of art in themselves, and they can be appreciated as such. But Marc Chagall taught me a really important lesson, not in person, but with his windows. I wish I could say that, but no. He actually made windows for quite a few churches and synagogues. And he glazed a small country church near Canterbury in the 1970s and 80s. Every single window in that church is filled with glass by Marc Chagall. It's the parish church of Tewdley. When you are in that very small space, which just consists of a small chancel and a nave, you realize that Chagall doesn't make stained glass windows. He paints the air in color. And that is something that you find in the Sainte-Chapelle, you find it in the Trinity Chapel of Canterbury Cathedral, you find it in St. Geryon's Church in Cologne, the best assemblies of stained glass windows, not just individual windows, but whole works of art, the German concept of the Gesamtkunstwerk. Those are the best expressions of the art of stained glass. It makes a building, it transforms a building entirely through colored light. And we're coming back to Suger here, the power of ordinary light being transformed through the passage of stained glass to something extraordinary.
Do you know, a parallel that comes to mind as you're describing this is that of a choir. And as you were describing the way that the windows come together in consonance with the light, in consonance with the building, in consonance with one another, makes me think of a choir versus an individual singer, that it's sort of like a community of windows and the artist's skill and the architect's skill in imagining how those different windows will come together in sort of a community or a choir of windows. Am I hearing you right? That it's sort of in groupings that you see stained glass best.
I think you've got that right, yes. I love that image of or that concept of a choir. I actually have a bit of synesthesia, the ability to hear colors or taste shapes. I sometimes try and bring that into my windows. And particularly sound plays a big role for me in the colors that I work with. So, yeah, a single window can do that if it is the main source of light in a building or in a part of a building. But certainly when you have groups of windows that talk to each other and transform the space with the color they create, with the light they create, then I think you have something extremely special. And that also is really important to remember when you make a new window for an existing space with existing historic stained glass windows. You can't just work for your one opening and, you know, what you want to do. It has to reflect everything around it. Otherwise, it becomes a selfish thing and possibly quite a damaging thing.
Yeah, it's more like a composition, like working with an existing composition than writing something out of the blue.
Joining a choir.
Or joining a choir. Now that you've brought up, you started to talk a little bit about, I think, in that some advice for people who may have stained glass in their churches. We have a lot of listeners, as you know, who are priests or even who are bishops or deans of cathedrals. What are some top things that you might want priests to consider about the stained glass that is in their churches? Word from the expert.
Well, first of all, congratulations. You have stained glass. That's wonderful. The wonderful thing is these can last for so long. They're an excellent investment if you have the long view in mind. They do need maintenance. So you need to have people look at them at least once every 5 years, or if you see any changes, get advice and get good advice. There are stained glass experts out there that can come and take a look and give you some advice. Please don't get your scrubbing brushes out and try and clean the inside of your windows where the painted decoration is. You can do damage because although the painted decoration is fired on and should be permanent, it isn't always perfectly fired. And so there is a example in, I think, a New York church where a very zealous church warden removed the dark lines in between the legs of Christ on the cross. So we now have a monolegged Christ. And I have seen similar things happening where you can see clearly how high up the church warden can reach with the extension on their scrubbing brush.
No.
Cleaning windows is important, but it needs to be done by people who know what they're doing and also people who know when not to do it. Get advice is my answer to that question. And of course, protective glazing is also a whole subject. We can talk for another hour just about protective glazing. It's often a very good idea to protect your windows against vandalism and against the elements. But if it's done wrong, if the physics aren't understood, and if it's not designed specifically for that window in that particular church, and based upon the environment that window experiences, then it can actually be harmful.
Okay. So basically, everyone needs to call Leonie to make sure.
I'm on the other side of the Atlantic. I mean, you know, I'll be happy to design windows, but I think there are plenty of very good experts in the United States that can help.
Leonie, I wonder if we could close our conversation today by hearing about one of your favorite stained glass windows. This could be one that you have observed. It could be one you've worked on. It could be one you've designed. Tell us about one of your favorite works of colored glass art.
My absolute favorite, again, is a group of windows, not just a single one. And it's what is known as the Beckett Miracle Windows in the Trinity Chapel of Canterbury Cathedral. They are 8 surviving windows out of an original set of 12. And they are the medieval version of graphic novels. They're based on eyewitness accounts of people experiencing significant change in their lives where their health is concerned, so healing, in the first 4 or 6 years after the murder of Thomas Becket in Canterbury Cathedral, the saint who never gave any indication that he would actually become a saint after his murder. He wasn't that kind of man. But he turned out to be one of Europe's most popular saints in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries. And hundreds of thousands of people made the pilgrimage from all over Europe, from Sicily up to Reykjavik, to Canterbury, to be here and ask Thomas. They had actually stationed a monk at the tomb of Thomas Becket to ask people who they are, what their names were, what their jobs were, where they lived, what their problems were. And they took that down in a book.
Hmm.
And so those accounts survive, and they are about absolutely everybody in society, from a blind leprous beggar to the Earl of Hereford. And those people really existed. They're not made up. And many of those stories are depicted in the windows in short 2, 3, or 6, or 9 panel sets. And they are incredibly moving, very beautifully put together. The beauty of the windows just overwhelms you because they are color-wise incredibly rich, but also the elegance and the emotional richness of the painting is just really unexpected for something that was made between 1190 and 1220. And everybody in these windows is treated with respect and dignity. There are no funny depictions of people having their demons expelled from their bodies out of, you know, all orifices, which is something you find very often in medieval art, not in these windows. And they're never alone. Everybody who travels to Canterbury in these windows is accompanied by a friend or a servant. People are not left to suffer on their own. And I found that incredibly helpful during COVID, because we were all faced with this unknown horror that could descend upon us. And these windows really gave me hope that we can get through this. They are so universal, and they're not bound in the Middle Ages. They just talk about people in trouble and facing it together, getting a little bit misty just talking about it.
It's really beautiful. And actually, now that you've said that, I had the joy of having a tour. I went with a pilgrimage group a couple years ago to Canterbury, and the dean gave us a tour, a private tour after closing. It was so sweet of him. And when these windows were a place where I also got really emotional when he explained to us that the people who were depicted here, all of these dozens and dozens of people, every face is distinct and every face has an expression. And you're right, everyone is depicted with equal dignity. I can't tell in these windows just by first glance who's wealthy, who's not, who's a friend, who's a servant. So there's this sort of, there's this equality among everyone who's coming to God through Thomas Becket for their miracle, their healing, and the tenderness on some of the faces, the desperation.
We are collaborating with an American historian who is essentially the world expert in Becket pilgrimage. She spent 20 years in the archives of Canterbury Cathedral. Every moment she had, she hopped over the Atlantic and did her research. And about 10 years ago, she came into my office and said, I think we should meet and talk about the windows. So we have been taking out the stained glass from each window, one after the other, to investigate exactly what is original, what is a later edition, and precisely who the people are that are depicted in these panels, because many of them were misidentified, were mixed up, had restorations that obliterated evidence. And so we are now finding out what we really have in these windows, whose stories are really depicted, and we're able to reorder some of them so that they are reunited. And that a historian's name is Rachel Koopmans, and she's publishing about the windows, and eventually there will be a whole new catalogue of all 8 windows.
Basically going through the manuscript of these windows and getting the story straight.
Yeah, and at the same time, we are able to undertake really vital conservation work on them so that they'll be there for the next 500 years, hopefully. But again, you know, as always, it is down to funds, and we work when we have the funds available.
Okay, so everyone donate to Canterbury Cathedral. It's easy to do. She's putting two thumbs up. Go to their website right now and give a donation. They would love that. I've been speaking today with Leonie Zilica, director of the Cathedral Studios of Canterbury and responsible for the conservation of the stained glass windows of Canterbury Cathedral. She's also a stained glass artist. Leonie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Amber, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for an interesting conversation.
Preacher, are you looking for new resources to make preaching each week a little easier and, dare I say it, maybe even fun? Well, you can join Episcopal priests Father Jacob Smith and Father Aaron Zimmerman for the Same Old Song podcast. Same Old Song. Each week, they break down the lectionary texts for the coming Sunday with gospel insight, a few appropriate cultural references, sometimes slightly inappropriate, and a heart for the sufferer in the pew and the pulpit. All in half an hour. Check out Same Old Song wherever you get your podcasts, or check out the link in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in to our conversation with Leonie. In today's bonus segment, we wish a happy semi-quincentennial to the United States with a quick history tour of Powhick Episcopal Church in Lorton, Virginia. Established when Virginia was still a colony, Powhick Parish has seen some interesting times that might have some illuminating lessons for ours. Our docent on that history tour is the Reverend Daniel Sensi, rector of Powhick Episcopal Church. We hope you enjoy the bonus chat. Can you tell me, Daniel, a little bit about your parish's history in relation to colonial times, especially around the Revolutionary War? What makes this history special?
We're called the Mother Church of Northern Virginia. We were the first church to be established north of the Occoquan River. So there was an early Chapel of Ease about 1695 in what was called the Overwharton Parish. And then that parish was divided to form the Hamilton Parish in about 1730. And then the parish was divided again to form what was called the Truro Parish. And Powhick became the parish church of the Truro Parish then. So the building that we have today isn't the 1730 building, or about 1730, but this building was built in 1774. We call it the new building, you know, so built between 1769 and 1774. One of the founding vestrymen was Augustine Washington, who was George Washington's father. He paid for the first priest that became the reverend here, Reverend Green. Later, by the time you get to the 1770s, George Washington is on the vestry now, along with George Mason, George William Fairfax, quite a few of those sort of colonial influential figures that were vestry members here. We have what's called the Great Font, and that was brought to the colonies in the 1730s and placed in the original Powhick Church, so the old church. So it came out of an 11th century monastery in England. And after the Protestant Reformation, the contents of the monasteries were confiscated by the crown. Oftentimes they were distributed to the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel to be taken to sort of the colonial churches that were being founded out in the world. Unfortunately, it was not a font at the monastery. It was a kitchen mortar. So they used it in the kitchen of the monastery. And it was later found after the Civil War being used as a watering trough in a local barn, so for horses.
There we go. I love it. Your original font used to be a kitchen mortar. Maybe the Christians who are baptized in it come out extra spicy.
Maybe. I hope so.
Hopefully they don't come out acting like a horse's ass, but that's
yes,
another.
Yes, no, hopefully not. Hopefully that part of the history is left out. So exactly.
I wonder, when you give tours of your church, what is one of your favorite stories to tell?
Well, it depends, like, if you're looking for a more like spicy story or more of like an interesting kind of cool historical fact. I don't know.
So, I will take either one or both.
Okay. So I think that the spicy story is that the first priest who was called to be here was accused by Lawrence Washington, who is George Washington's half-brother, of inappropriate relations with Lawrence's wife. this became like a huge ecclesiastical trial, and that the priest then, of course, claimed he was innocent. He wanted to sue Lawrence Washington for defamation and all this. And so this trial went to Williamsburg, and the governor of Virginia stepped in and was able to make enough peace that the priest could return to his post at the church. Lawrence Washington wasn't happy about it, but he stopped claiming that the priest had committed an affair with his wife. And so they moved on, and he ended up staying for about 20 more years as the rector of the parish.
Wow, colonial Title IV drama.
Exactly. Another kind of cool story is from the Civil War era that we like to, the Union Army occupied Northern Virginia, and they used the church as a garrison. There was a guy that he was called an aeronaut, so he was interested in like hot air balloons, and convinced the Union Army that he could help spy on the Confederate forces with these hot air balloons that he had experimented with. And so they launched the first successful hot air balloon missions from the graveyard of Pohick Church to spy on the Confederate forces across the Occoquan River. And it led to Union victory. So it was one of the...
Oh, so it actually worked?
It worked, yeah. An interesting story about the location, the current church, that it's the first church wasn't in the same location as this current church. It was about 2 miles closer to the Occoquan River from where we are now. You know, the church was getting dilapidated. It was wooden. So the vestry wanted to build a new brick structure. And Washington felt like the church was too far away from Mount Vernon. It was much closer to Gunston Hall, which is George Mason's home. And so Washington and Mason get into this heated debate during a vestry meeting as to where the church should be located. George Mason wanted it to stay where it was. He had family buried in the churchyard there. Washington wanted it moved closer to Mount Vernon. So they didn't come to a consensus. Washington left, and he was a surveyor. So he surveyed all of the plantations of the vestry members and determined what was the most convenient location to all of the plantations and determined that this was the location that the church should be built. They went back to the vestry meeting. He presented this information, and George Mason said something along the lines of, "This is what I get for entering into a debate with a damned surveyor," you know, and he conceded and they built the church. So here we are today, an example of early political, discourse and negotiation.
I have mixed feelings about Washington's strategy there, trying to negotiate with everyone, but in kind of a bossy way. Was he kind of a bossy guy? This is kind of the impression I'm getting from the stories you're telling.
I think he knew what he wanted, and he could find a way to get it. He wasn't above negotiating or working with other people reaching across the aisle. You know, you see that a lot with Washington, stories about him and Thomas Jefferson and, you know, different other founders that he didn't really necessarily always get along with, but he could find sort of that common ground and say, let's just figure out how we can make this work. You have sort of this overlap of people who are deeply devout, very involved in their faith community, but are also extremely involved politically. Another really cool story, George Fairfax, we call them the three Georges, George Mason, George Washington, and George William Fairfax. George Fairfax was a loyalist, you know, so he felt very strongly that the colony of Virginia did not need to declare independence, did not need to separate from the crown. So he and his wife actually went back to England. They claimed it was for personal affairs, you know, but they went back to England and never returned. But George Washington, being the gentleman that he was, continued to write back and forth to George Fairfax. He even held his property and eventually oversaw the sale of the property on behalf of the Fairfax family so that they could have their assets and live in England after the Revolutionary War. I think the relationship between the Washingtons and the Fairfaxes is a great example of, you know, they were on opposite sides of a violent revolution and they stayed friends. There was this idea of seeing each other as respected individuals, as children of God, as fellow vestry members, fellow parishioners in the church, even though they strongly disagreed on what was the best course for Virginia to take. I'm a Reformed Anglican, so I think we're all on the bad side. So, you know, we're all in need of grace, you know. So that's kind of my take on it.
What do you hope that the states will be celebrating at our 500th birthday, should the Lord grant a 500th birthday?
America is a temporal nation, and it will never be the kingdom of God. And I think that any country should strive for justice and equality and freedom and liberty and all of the things that our founding fathers and mothers put forth, you know, in those early days of our country, that we should always be moving toward that. And as Christians, we should be moving toward that with the lens of we are looking forward to the coming of God's eternal kingdom, which is even greater than any kingdom that man has ever seen or any republic that man has ever established. I love our country, and I think we have a wonderful system of government that when it works well, but it's not the kingdom of God. And I think Washington would say the same thing. And so I think, you know, in 500 years, I hope if Jesus hasn't come back, I hope we're still striving for that and still trying to become what they would call a more perfect nation, to be a place where no one is judged on their race or their socioeconomic status or their gender or whatever, you know, but they're judged on the fact that they are created equal in the eyes of God and our children of God. And I hope that we can be that kind of country. And I hope that as Christians, we can be that kind of Christian.
I've been speaking today with the Reverend Daniel Sensi, rector of Pohick Episcopal Church in Lorton, Virginia. Daniel, thanks so much for a very appropriate month of July of the 250th birthday of America bonus chat.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to be with you.
Thanks for tuning into the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, we've got a special news desk covering the recent Anglican Consultative Council meeting in Northern Ireland. What were the highlights of that meeting, challenges, and remaining questions for the Anglican Communion? We might even get a few snippets of editor Mark Michael's Irish adventures. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.